Thank you, Jason, for leading those songs. Jason is actually the fill-in for the fill-in, and I appreciate him filling in for me on kind of some short notice. If you want to, go ahead and grab your Bibles, open up back to Daniel chapter 5. That's where we'll be looking for most of our evening together tonight. Daniel's always been an intriguing Bible character to me, because he's just really mentioned in this one little short book, especially as a kid, because here he is able to stand up before a king. He's able to stand up for the things that he believes in hostile territory, as he's been dragged into captivity here by the Babylonians. I can't imagine as a teenager what it would have been like to have to stand in the face of a king and his servants and say, you know what, I'm not going to eat that. Later in life, to stand before the king and say, you know what, I just can't bow down and worship you. If you want to do that, if you want me to do that, you know, you're going to have to throw me into the lion's den. He was able to trust in God with his whole heart, and for so many reasons, even these, I came to admire Daniel. You know, we're introduced to him actually in very small snippets of his life, little short stories. With sometimes decades in between. You know, we're introduced to him in the beginning as he's carried into captivity and as he makes the stand on the food. Later, we're introduced to his three friends, and that's really about all that we read about him. In chapter 4, King Nebuchadnezzar, the king who had carried him into captivity, finds himself going against God. And God comes to him and says, all right, King Nebuchadnezzar, I brought you all the way up here. You forgot about me. I'm going to have to humble you now. And he actually lived with the donkeys, with the wild animals for about 7 years. I read that and the pictures that come to mind just absolutely blow me away. And by the time we come to chapter 5, it has been, quote unquote, many years later. Which I have no idea how long it is, but I do find that very interesting, that it's many years after Nebuchadnezzar was out in the field with the wild animals. It's actually about 70 years or so after Daniel was brought into captivity in the first place. So when I'm thinking of Daniel and I'm reading it, I'm hearing the Bible stories as a little kid, I picture, you know, this young teenager doing all of these things. And little did I know that by the time we get to this story right before he's thrown into the lion's den, that Daniel's probably somewhere in the range of 80 years old. An old man. He's still able to stand up for the things that he believes in. He's still able to stand up against kings. And that just blows my mind. The year that we find him in now is actually 539 BC, if you can see these pictures. I hope you can. This is a few pictures of Babylon that I found. It's a great city, a beautiful city, and if I remember right from my history classes in grade school, it was even part of the seven wonders of the world. It's in modern-day Iraq. It's in between the Tigris and the Euphrates River, and it was actually really interesting because the Euphrates River flows through the city. The city had built up around it and had grown so large that it actually spanned the river. They built their walls over the river. The walls that went around the city actually went over the river so that if somebody were to try to attack them by boat, they could not get under the walls. They couldn't come in by surprise because the walls were so low over the water. It's an amazing city. The walls, it's outside walls. This is a picture of some of the original walls, were actually stretched about 15 miles all the way around the city. And at places it said that they were about 85 feet high. And all around the wall they had watchtowers so that the soldiers could stand there, they could stand guard, they could stand watch over the city, and they could see people coming for literally miles and miles around because these walls were so high. Not only were they high, here again, they were very thick, they were very ornate, as you can see here. That just adds to the beauty of this city. But outside this amazing city, as we've seen all of its walls, all of its buildings, all of its ornate designs, all of the beauty of this city, outside of its great walls, trouble is coming. The great Persian army that Daniel had actually prophesied about 50 years earlier is coming near. This huge army that's been prophesied about, Daniel says, you know, this is going to be the kingdom that overthrows Babylon. He had actually prophesied this to Nebuchadnezzar. This army is coming. And if I were a citizen of that particular city, I think I probably would have been shaking in my shoes. I probably would have been trying to figure out how to get myself out of there as fast as I possibly could. But if you were to look inside the gates of this city, you would have absolutely no idea that any such attack was coming. No idea of the terrible fate that probably awaited you in just the next couple of days even. Why in the world should they be afraid? They had all of these huge walls. They had all of these huge towers. They had all of their armies. They had up to 20 years worth of food stored away inside of their city. What in the world did they have to be afraid of? Who or what army could come and conquer them? You know, if you're looking at it just from an outsider's perspective, from our perspective, they've got it made, don't they? Shut up behind their walls, behind their gates with all of their food, with adequate water flowing through your city, who's going to come after you? And that's kind of where we pick up, as we picked up with our scripture reading in verses 1 through 4 of chapter 5. You know, there's this buzz going around town. You know, you can't hardly help but miss it when you go down to the river, you go down to the well to pick up the water for the day. Everybody is talking about it. Something big is happening. Belshazzar has invited 1,000 of his nobles, 1,000 of the richest, most powerful, highest paid people in his kingdom have been invited to the city for a huge party. I mean, if you stop to think about it, there are 1,000 nobles who have been invited if they bring their wives, their concubines, their servants, and their their kids, their guard, the people who guard and watch over them. I mean, you're talking about a party that numbers in the tens of thousands of people. This is a huge deal, a huge buzz around the city. And it was a very clever diversion on the part of the king. You got to give him a little bit of credit here to know that outside the wall is this army, but inside the wall, man, it is a party. It is a good time. This is what living really is when we can throw a party like this. In ancient times, you needed three things for a successful party. You needed a lot of food, you needed a lot of wine, and you needed a lot of women. This is the kind of party that would have started early, early in the morning. They would have started serving the food, they would have started serving the wine almost at sun up. Get the party started off on the right foot. And it would have lasted till well after midnight. I mean, we think we throw good parties now, and when we see things on TV, we think, man, look how much fun that is. It didn't hold a candle up to this party. And apparently, this party was a complete success, wasn't it? The wine was flowing freely. Everybody was starting to feel good. Everybody was well fed. They were probably to the point of being stuffed. It's almost like Thanksgiving all over again. You know that feeling that you get after you've had your meal and you've got to go and you just got to kick back in the chair and take a nap. They are feeling great. And like all hosts, all good hosts, our King Belshazzar has a fantastic idea. He calls over his servants and he whispers in their ear. He says, you know what? I want you to go. I want you to go into the treasury. I want you to get all the goblets, all the glasses that my grandpa brought from Israel, that he brought from the temple of God. I want you to go and I want you to get those and I want you to bring them out here so that we can drink out of them. That sounds like a great idea, doesn't it? He's a good host. He's doing what good hosts do. He's bringing out the wealth. He's showing off. He's taking the party to the next level. And, you know, you can almost picture as the servants come back into the room, all of the oohs and all of the ahs that are coming from the crowd as they see these glasses, as the people, as they pass them, person to person, because there were only about 70 of them, you can imagine. As they went around the room, as people were taking drinks out of them, as people were drinking maybe even some of the best wine of the day. As they go around, and the people start feeling a little bit better about themselves, somebody starts to sing a little song, maybe just quietly amongst themselves. But their neighbors hear it, and they all join in. And before long, the entire party is singing this song of praise to the Babylonian gods. And they spend the afternoon and into the evening singing praises and making prayers to their own Babylonian gods. They praise the gods of gold and silver and of stone. What a better direction for the party to take if you are the host. This was precisely the diversion that the king was after, wasn't it? Get them going, get them feeling good, get them to praising their gods, giving glory to the gods of the Babylonians who have brought them great victory, who have brought them all of these great spoils. Everyone was clearly focused on anything and everything but the looming Persian army. And if you're an honest reader, at this point in the story, you're probably sitting there and you're wondering, okay, well, where in the world is Daniel in all of this? Like, what is Daniel doing? And I don't know. A reasonable guess is that he is not at the party, that he's probably off somewhere in his room, as we find him in many other parts of his story, praying to his God, just going about his normal daily business, trying to stay away from the party that's been going on, trying not to pay very much attention to it. But you can bet that there has been somebody that's been watching. He's been watching since the very first glass of wine was poured. And in verse 5, we come to quite possibly the scariest and most Halloween-esque verse in the entire Bible, since we are getting close to the month of October and all of the scary things that go along with it. As you come to this verse, let's just read it together. It says that suddenly a human hand appeared and began writing on the plaster wall of the palace, where the light from the lamps was shining most brightly, and the king saw the hand as it was writing. Can you imagine how creepy that might have been if you were King Belshazzar at this point in your life? God comes and God crashes this party in dramatic fashion, doesn't he? I mean, just all of a sudden, here's his hand writing on the wall. He sure knows how to kill all the fun, doesn't he? Without even having to read the following verses, you can almost picture all of the color as it drains from the king's face. As he notices nothing but a hand, no head, no torso, no legs, no arms, nothing but a hand writing on the wall. As I was searching, I actually came across a picture. Rembrandt did his own version of this. I'm going to leave that up there for you guys for a little bit. But this was God's handwriting on the wall. The color drains from his face. You can almost see his knees buckle as he's collapsing back into his chair, hoping that maybe nobody else notices. Nobody sees what's going on. The fun hasn't been ruined yet. And then that awkward moment when he realizes that all of the fun has stopped. Nobody is singing anymore. Nobody is dancing anymore. Nobody is eating anymore. And they're just sitting there, just probably completely mesmerized and totally afraid of what they're seeing. Being the quick thinker that he is, he automatically calls for all the magicians and enchanters that he could possibly find in his kingdom. And he says, "Bring them to me." He says, "This is the deal. If they can read this, if they can interpret this for me, I'll wrap them in a purple robe. I will put a gold chain around their neck. They will be promoted to third in the kingdom." Third in the kingdom. That's a pretty good deal. That's as high as this king could possibly promote someone. Third in the kingdom. That's a pretty good deal. And as they come in one by one, by one, by one, I don't know how many they were, but if it was over 100, I mean, you can just imagine that with each passing person, as the air kind of goes out of the room, the hope kind of goes out of the room, is, man, we don't know what this is. Nobody knows what this is. It was getting late. And from somewhere else in the palace, probably, the king's mother hears all of the noise that's going on. Everything that's going on down the hall, all the screams, all the shrieks, she hears what's happening. And she runs to the big giant banquet hall to see what's going on, to see what all of the trouble is, hoping that nothing terrible has happened. And as she gets there, she sees. This is probably Nebuchadnezzar's daughter, actually, which was an interesting thing for me. As she hears all the noise, she comes running into the hall. She knows one thing to do. She knows who to call, and it's not the Ghostbusters. If she was Nebuchadnezzar's daughter, she probably had good memories of this guy who rescued Nebuchadnezzar on several occasions, who could interpret dreams, who could interpret signs, who could tell you what was going on. He had saved the king from so many tough situations. Surely he could help again. If you look in verse 11, he says, "There's a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. When your father was king, this man showed good sense, knowledge, and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, made him chief of the fortune tellers, magicians, wizards, and astrologers. He has unusual ability and is wise and skillful in interpreting dreams, solving riddles, and explaining mysteries. So send for this man Daniel, whom the king had named Belteshazzar, and he will tell you what all of this means." She was a wise woman, like any mom in the audience. She had her head about her. She knew where to turn when things got tough. So finally, our hero is here. Daniel has arrived on the scene in verses 13 through 16. Daniel was brought at once into the king's presence, and the king said to him, "Are you Daniel, that Jewish exile whom my father the king brought here from Judah? I have heard that the spirit of the holy gods is in you, and that you are skillful and have knowledge and wisdom. The advisors and magicians were brought in to read this writing and tell me what it means, but they could not discover the meaning. Now I have heard that you can find hidden meanings and explain mysteries. If you can read this writing and tell me what it means, you will be dressed in robes of royal purple, wear a gold chain of honor around your neck, and be the third in power in the kingdom." The wise king makes the exact same deal with Daniel that he made with his own magicians. You get the robe, you get the gold, you get to be number three in the kingdom. I love his response there in verse 17 that says that Daniel replied, "Keep your gifts to yourself or give them to someone else. I will read for your majesty what has been written and tell you what it means." He says, "I don't need those things. I don't care about those things. I know that there is a God out there that has been providing for me all these years, and he's going to continue to provide for me now. Keep it all. I don't need it, but I'm going to tell you what it means anyways." His reply is fairly brief in Bible terms. And we're going to look at his reply, and I believe in his reply, he gives the king at least three lessons that I want us to take a little bit closer look at first. Number one, starting in verse 18, I think we find a history lesson. He says, "The supreme God made your father Nebuchadnezzar a great king and gave him dignity and majesty. He was so great that the people of all nations, races, and languages were afraid of him and trembled. If he wanted to kill someone, he did. And if he wanted to keep someone alive, he did. He honored or disgraced anyone he wanted to. But because he became proud, stubborn, and cruel, he was removed from his royal throne and lost his place of honor. He was driven away from human society, and his mind became like that of an animal. He lived with the wild donkeys, ate grass like an ox, and slept in the open air with nothing to protect him from the dew. Finally, he admitted that the supreme God controls all human kingdoms and can give them to anyone he chooses. But you, his son, have not humbled yourself, even though you knew all of this." It's almost like this is the dirty, dark family secret that everybody's been trying to hide. And Daniel brings it back into light and throws it in his face in this lesson of history. He reminds him that it was God who did all of this for his grandfather, and he knows this. It was God who brought him to power, and it was God who took him out into the field and humbled him among the wild animals. God was in control. In verse 23, I think we get a lesson in theology. He says, "You acted against the Lord of heaven and brought in the cups and bowls taken from his temple. You, your noblemen, your wives, and your concubines drank wine out of them and praised gods made of gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone, gods that cannot see or hear and that do not know anything. But you did not honor the God who determines whether you live or die and who controls everything that you do." King Belshazzar had clearly set himself up against the God of heaven. With his actions, he had taken a direct and public and premeditated assault on God himself. The thing that he did, as innocent as it might have been in his mind, was an attack on God. And God was there to humble him through it. As we continue in verse 24, I think we get a lesson in reading. He says, "That is why God has sent the hand to write these words. And this is what was written, Mene, Mene, Tekel, and Peresen." And this is what it means. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the scales and found to be too light. Peresen, your kingdom is divided up and given to the Medes and the Persians. These mysterious words of God are God's way of saying it's over. Your days have been numbered, your kingdom has been weighed, and all of this, it's over. You haven't done the things that have been asked of you. You haven't paid attention to history. You haven't paid attention to your theology. And now God has judged you. It's as if, if I were king at this point, Daniel might not have been so lucky. But the king honors his promise. He gives him the robe. He gives him the chain of gold. And he sets him at number three in the kingdom. It's almost as if he knows that, Daniel's right. It's almost like he's resolved and he's just ready to accept it. He knows that the thing that he did was wrong. His life comes to an end very quickly. In verse 30, it says that that very night, the king was killed. History can fill in a few gaps for us. The waiting army of the Persians had actually managed to divert the mighty river Euphrates. And as they diverted it, they were able to come in underneath that wall that was supposed to keep them safe. And history tells us that they came in right in the middle of a huge party that was going on. People were drunk, people were eating, lots of things going on. And this is what the army came into. They had no problem taking over at that point. The question for the rest of our time tonight is very simple. And that is, what does this mean for us? As we sit in this auditorium 2,500 and some odd years later, what does this mean to you and I? There's so many life applications that you can take from this story that you can put into your life. Some of them can get pretty wild and pretty far-fetched. I want to keep it very simple and suggest that we too probably need these same very three lessons. That we need a lesson in history. As we go throughout our lives, we need to remember where we were. Where we were before we got to where we are now. Whether it's in our jobs, whether it's at school, whether it's in sports, anything you can possibly name. You were small once, you probably weren't very good at it. If you've risen to power in your job, if you've risen to popularity in your school, if you've become one of the star athletes in whatever it is that you do, we got there because of God. Anyone who has ever come to great power or great fame is there because of God. even as we reflect back on our own history and the lessons that we need to learn from. The things that happened, the things that brought us to where we are today was all because of God. And at some point, it seems that nearly every single one of us manages to forget about God. We start to think that somehow we've managed to do all of this on our own. We've managed to become popular. We've managed to become powerful all by ourselves. And that's where this little lesson comes in, the lesson in theology. We forget about God. We can't forget about God because forgetting about God causes us to take Him for granted. And we can't take God for granted. A promotion isn't ours. The wealth that's not ours, the power that we've gained throughout our lives is not ours. It's not there because of anything that we did. In the moment that we forget, we set ourselves up against the God of heaven. The moment that we forget that it was God that brought us and made us who we are today is the moment that we find ourselves directly opposed to the God of heaven. We too also need a lesson in reading. Yes, keeping up with our daily Bible readings, making sure that we're in the Word, but we also need to remember that handwriting on the wall. The things have been numbered, things have been weighed. We have to remember that one day we'll have to answer to God for everything that we've done in our lives. Here in this story, God brings judgment very quickly. In our lives, sometimes that's the case. More often than not, our judgment is delayed for a little bit, isn't it? One day we're going to have to give an answer. It brings to mind one of my favorite movie quotes from A Knight's Tale. As they stand over, the evil knight at the end, and the people look over him and they say, "You have been weighed, you've been measured, and you've been found wanting." I hope that that is not what God says to us. When we get to those end of days as He judges the things that we did, our lives are numbered. The good deeds and even the bad deeds that we've done in our lives will be weighed. And after that, we find out what in the world it is that happens to us. And tonight, I'm just wondering how many of us might need these three simple lessons that we find here in the book of Daniel. Just as God humbled proud kings, He can do the same to us. This chapter shows us that our place is at His feet in obedience, submission, and gratitude. They teach us, as clearly as anything could, the first rule of spiritual life, that He is God and we're not. Until we learn that truth, we're still in spiritual kindergarten. We have a lot of lessons that we need to learn in our lives, and these are three of the most important that I could possibly think of. I don't know where you are in your life right now, whether or not you need to take advantage of these three lessons. But if there is anything that we can do for you, if we can pray for you, just a simple thing like that can sometimes mean so much. If you need to give your life over to Christ, we ask that you please do that now as we stand and as we sing.